This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a distinguished scholar at NCAR, the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. He also works with the University of Auckland. Kevin was the lead author of the 2001 and 2007 IPCC Scientific Assessment of Climate Change. From Auckland, New Zealand, Kevin Trenberth, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
You are co-author of another new paper with an amazing team of scientists. Could you please tell us the title of your new paper?
Well, the latest paper is just another year of record heat for the oceans, and so this deals with the year 2022 being, again, an all-time record for the amount of ocean heat.
Would you talk to us, for example, how hotter oceans can add more energy to storms and then we get more extreme weather?
Well, you know, climate change is happening, and the main cause is the increases in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and it produces global warming, global heating, so to speak. And most of that heat, over 90% of it, ends up in the ocean. But ends up is an important point because some of it goes in and out and comes back again. And having warmer oceans has consequences for all of the weather events that are occurring above the oceans. In particular, over the oceans in general, there is more water vapor in the atmosphere than there ever was before. And so as storms begin to develop, they normally do that in much the same way they used to, but now they immediately encounter this extra water vapor in the atmosphere, and it gives them a boost, this extra latent heat, this extra heat that went into evaporating the moisture in the first place that fuels these storms, and it often intensifies them, and it certainly adds to the rainfall rates. And so this has consequences on all kinds of scales, whether it's a small-scale storm that may cause floods locally, and there's been a huge number of those in California recently, for instance, or whether it's basically hemispheric scale or continental scale. And this relates to things like the big cold outbreak that occurred in the United States in December last year. And also, right now, in January, around the 22nd of January, some of the coldest temperatures ever on record occurred in eastern China. Russia, but eastern Asia. And, you know, the temperatures were below minus 50 degrees Celsius. It's absolutely incredible. And it was very cold over all of Siberia. And it was cold over parts of the U.S., but it was extraordinarily warm over the Pacific and southern Alaska. And it was extraordinarily warm over the entire Atlantic, going all the way up to Spitsbergen. And so this includes Norway and Sweden. Extremely warm. And so the key thing to take away from this is, though this very cold in spots, it's also extraordinarily warm in other spots. And so this turns out to be a part of the consequence of having warmer oceans, that it can help intensify even these very large-scale waves in the atmosphere and have consequences both on the warm side and the cold side in terms of snow and rainfall.
And it's intriguing to learn that the ocean is heating into deeper layers, and that means when something like a hurricane comes along, it might have spun down and pulled up some cold water, and that would slow down the hurricane, but now there's warm water even deeper, so it keeps on going.
Yes, and this is, of course, true not just for hurricanes, but also all other storms. The sea surface temperatures are what the storms initially see, but very quickly the mixing in the upper ocean occurs with the winds in the storm, and so that's not what ultimately counts. It's really the top 100 meters of the ocean which is interacting with the atmosphere, and as you say, the hurricanes are one of the phenomena that actually go down, I would say, 150 meters typically in terms of tapping the heat that's there. And so having a warmer ocean beneath the hurricane indeed enables it to be refueled and intensified and drop very heavy rains. And this is indeed what's happening.
All right. Well, let's try to tackle a long list of short questions with huge answers. And I'll advance a point from the new study and then wait for your comments. And here's number one. Ocean heating may be the best and real indicator of how badly the energy imbalance is getting on this planet.
Yes, the steadiness of the increases in the ocean show that it's the best single indicator of global warming or global climate change, if you like to think of that. And the second best is sea level rise, which is actually related in a way, but it also has an ingredient from the melting of ice. And both of these phenomena are affected by things like the El Nino phenomenon, La Nina. So in El Nino events, there's more rain over the oceans than over land. And as a result, that has consequences for how much water there is on land. And so this affects sea level rise. But yes, ocean heat, the changes in ocean heat content are the best measure of the fact that we're heating up the planet relentlessly. And the oceans have now warmed to a point where they are indeed influencing all of the weather events that are going on above them.
So what has the heat got to do with the salt content, the salinity, and why does that matter for ocean circulation?
So one of the things that we explored in this latest paper was indeed the changes in salinity in the ocean. This is an update of earlier work that we did. And there's quite strong patterns of salinity around the ocean. So this relates a lot to rainfall. The Pacific is quite a bit fresher than the Atlantic. And there's more rain over the Pacific than there is over the Atlantic. The Atlantic is fed by things like the Amazon, where there's fresh water coming in from over land, but there's a lot more rainfall that occurs over the land that doesn't get into the Atlantic in that case. And one of the things we found is that the regions where it's already fresh in the ocean are getting fresher, and the regions where it's already saline in the ocean, very salty, are getting saltier. And it highlights the fact that the rainfall over the oceans is intensifying, but it means that the dry spots are actually getting drier and the wet spots are getting wetter. So it's raining harder over the oceans where it already used to rain, and in the places where it's relatively dry, it's raining less. And of course, this extends to the land, and we see this with things like the floods and the droughts over land. Except over land, it's a lot more complicated because of the topography and because places like deserts don't ever get rain. So one has to take into account the availability of moisture from somewhere. And over the oceans, of course, there's no limit to the availability of moisture. So it's a very good indicator as to what is happening with regard to what we call the hydrological cycle or the water cycle.
So does continued warming tend to weaken the great conveyor belt of ocean circulation, including the current that warms eastern North America and northern Europe?
Well, it may well do. One of the things that happens, and another aspect of the paper that we looked at, is indeed the vertical structure of the warming. And since the warming is occurring from the surface, from the atmosphere down, and warm water on top of cold water is a stable configuration, it means that the stratification of the oceans is increasing. But nonetheless, we can monitor how rapidly the heat is penetrating into the oceans, and going down to 2 kilometers depth is where we can really track it well. And, you know, it takes a couple of decades for the heat to penetrate that far. And so this alters the structure of the upper ocean, and it has consequences for mixing of all sorts of things in the ocean, including oxygen. And so this affects all organisms within the ocean. It has effects on kelp farms, if you like to think of that way, or kelp forests, and all kinds of the whole of the life chain in the oceans, from the plankton to the fish to the marine mammals to birds and so on, are being affected by these changes. And so it can potentially also then affect some of the big ocean currents. You referred to the conveyor belt, and so this is, you know, the very large-scale changes that are especially important in the Atlantic, for instance. It includes the Gulf Stream.
Yes, our next guest is Dr. Keith Moore from the University of California at Irvine, and he just published a study in Nature with other authors, and they're finding that a reduced circulation could mean the stratification could lead to a kind of slow starvation in the seas right at the base of the food chain. Your thoughts?
Yes, well, I think that's consistent with what I was just saying, that indeed the oceans are likely to become more stratified. The thing which compensates for that is whether we have, you know, storms over the ocean, which cause strong winds, and then the winds can mix up the ocean, and so that helps enormously. But in the absence of strong winds, the stratification becomes greater, and it does have an adverse effect on all of the organisms.
Why does heating of the seas reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that they can hold?
Well, the oceans become more stable, which means not only oxygen, but also carbon dioxide penetration into the ocean tends to be reduced. But in addition, the ocean, as it gets warmer, can hold less carbon dioxide. This is the sort of thing that happens when you have a pot of water on the stove and you heat it up, bubbles come out. And so as the water gets hotter, all of these bubbles come out. And you might think, where do these bubbles come from? Well, you know, it turns out the water can hold quite a bit of the atmosphere. And it's similarly true with carbon dioxide. And so warmer water, in some sense, boils off carbon dioxide. And as a result, more carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere, and it intensifies the climate change, which is already going on. So at the moment, about, what, a quarter to 30% of the carbon dioxide goes into the oceans, and that is likely to be cut in the future.
A review done by Maurice Huguenin, published in Nature September 2022, looked at the distribution of ocean heat uptake, and he found the Southern Ocean was taking up most of the added heat. Your comments, Kevin?
Yes, well, we certainly find the Southern Ocean is one place where there's a lot of heat being taken up. And, of course, that's partly because the Southern Ocean is so extensive. It goes all the way around the globe, at least at 60 degrees south it does, and it extends over a huge portion of the planet. But the Atlantic is also warming up at just as fast. Overall, and more so than the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. So, yes, I wouldn't discount the Atlantic either.
Yes, the main fishers could tell you the waters off New England are getting too warm for some of the commercial species, and so it can be a regional thing. Due to time limits, I think we're going to leave out increasing marine sea heat waves, the ocean heat waves, even though they are so harmful to life. But you and I talked about those in previous interviews, so I'm just going to post links to that in my blog. My next question really is, what about hotter seas expanding, adding to sea level rise? Is that happening, and should we expect more of that?
So as heat goes into the ocean, indeed, it expands. And this contributes probably to about 40% of sea level rise overall. The rest of it comes from the melting of land ice. So this is Greenland, Antarctica, and all of the glaciers all around the world that produce more water and fill up the ocean a little bit more. And so, yes, sea level rise is one of the key consequences of global heating, and the ocean increases in temperature contribute to that.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website, We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Kevin Trenberth. And we're talking about record hot oceans and what that means. You mentioned earlier a loss of oxygen as the seas heat up, but should we worry about that?
Yeah, so loss of oxygen is certainly one of the consequences of the increased stratification of the ocean. And that affects all of the marine life, from the smallest organisms, and including the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, the fish, the birds, the marine mammals, and so on. So it has consequences for human society as well.
And it sounds like we're making a big commitment for the long-term future. I mean, if we stumble along for another few decades using fossil fuels, raising the greenhouse gas levels, what is the long-term future for ocean heating?
Ocean heating is likely to continue even after or if we are able to stabilize the atmospheric concentrations of the greenhouse gases. So this means getting to so-called net zero. If we can cut emissions to zero of carbon into the atmosphere from carbon dioxide and natural gas methane, then the oceans still slowly warm up because the heat penetrates very slowly into the oceans, and sea level rise continues for decades or maybe even centuries after the stabilization of the climate system. So because stabilization of the climate system is far from guaranteed anyway, rising sea level is indeed a big concern.
So for this new study, two teams, Chinese and American mainly, compared results from a wide range of instrumental measurements. Were there differences in the conclusions, and does this approach make the science more reliable?
Yes, so this is one of the good things about the study, is that there were 16 different institutes worldwide that were actually involved in helping to write it. But there were two key institutions that were separately processing all of the data, all of the information about the changes in the temperatures in the ocean. And their approaches are somewhat different. I think the U.S. group from the National Center for Environmental Institutes is not quite as good as the Chinese group in this particular case. If you look at their products, you will see that they've got a lot more spotty changes, and it relates to how they treat the areas where there is no data. But having different approaches gives us a good idea as to what the different assumptions that go into the processing do to the outcome. And it turns out that the changes in the warming from last year are quite similar between the two groups.
America's taking very little effective climate action. In fact, American corporations are investing and expanding fossil fuel production as we speak. Have you any indications how seriously the government of China is taking the threat of ocean heating? What do their scientists say?
So I've seen changes in how the Chinese government has approached this. There was a time, let's see, about in the 2000s, where they were in complete denial of climate change and were very difficult to deal with in international negotiations of wording, for instance, in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports that I was involved in. And then there was a change, and I think the Chinese scientists finally got to the Chinese government to say that, look, China is a part of the world, and we're suffering from increasing droughts and floods. And indeed, there's been a number of examples of that, and they also suffer from typhoons, hurricanes that go into China. And so there's been a realization that indeed China is being affected by climate change, and so they've changed their approach. Certainly, it's been much easier to deal with on an international negotiation of, say, wording for various kinds of documents and agreements in dealing with China. But China still really only deals, in my view, China really only still deals with this from the point of view of how it benefits China, not how it benefits the world. And, you know, although China's a big, you know, an important part of the world, I don't think they're doing it to really help the overall climate change problem. They're only, anything they do is really to help China.
I'm not sure that's different from any other country I know. But anyway, is anybody even trying to slow ocean warming? I don't even hear discussion about it.
Yeah, so this relates to overall climate change. And, of course, the Conference of Parties, the COP meetings that occur annually are supposed to deal with this. But this deals with the entire United Nations, some, you know, nearly 200 countries. And it's very, very cumbersome, and they make very little progress. Certainly the last COP in Egypt was, I thought, very unproductive. The previous one in England, in Glasgow, Scotland, was certainly a little more productive. But I think more likely the places where advances can be made are in the G20 or the G7 through negotiations with the countries that actually cause most of the problems. And that's where we should look to. But, you know, when there's a war going on between, you know, the Ukraine and Russia, this is very bad for the environment, very bad for climate, and I think most people's attentions are just elsewhere at the moment. It's very unfortunate.
Well, certainly, and there's also the pandemic, and what we're seeing there is a huge ability of both the media and the leadership to deny that the problem is continuing, and that looks very bad for us really facing up to climate change. So there is a lot of pessimism that we'll tackle this greenhouse problem at all, and the fallback position has been in some quarters either geoengineering or adaptation. Do you think those can be done? Is that realistic as an out?
I do not really think so. There's a lot of talk about offsets, growing trees. And growing trees is very popular, and yet there's tremendous evidence now that this is largely unsuccessful, and that maybe 5 to 10% of the claimed offsets are actually occurring. And part of it's because, you know, trees only last a finite lifetime. They get diseased. There's been a lot of forest fires that have burned down. There's a lot of deforestation that has occurred. Overall, trees have not really helped that much. And the idea of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, I think, is really quite absurd because it's so expensive and it actually takes a lot of energy. And even if you can use renewable energy to do that, the amount that you can actually take out of the atmosphere is trivial. It hardly makes a blip, and it's extremely expensive. So that's where a tremendous amount of money is going in several countries and through a number of big industrial concerns. But that's not the way we're going to solve this problem. That is not going to solve the problem at all. We need to cut emissions. We need to keep the coal that already is out there in the ground and not burn it in the first place.
As we wrap up here, do you have any last words?
Well, climate change is a very real problem, and the changes that are going on in the ocean are now at a point where they're interacting with the atmosphere and contributing to the extremes that we see, and especially the heavy rainfalls, the potential for flooding, and also where it's not raining, you know, drought conditions. And these in turn lead to heat waves. And so I think the public is becoming more aware that all of these extremes do relate to climate change, and they are having major consequences. So there is indeed pressure to take action and to make appropriate cuts in emissions of greenhouse gases, of carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere. But progress is way too slow at the moment.
From New Zealand, we have been speaking with the distinguished scholar, Dr. Kevin Trenberth. Kevin is co-author of a study reporting record heat in the ocean for a third year in a row. Find links to follow up in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you so much for keeping our listeners so well informed.
Well, thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.